Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of Zach on Film. This week it is me, Zach, and across the room, Steven Schleicher.
Hello.
Steven, we went to the movie theater.
Yes.
Separate times,
yes.
But we still watched the same movie.
Right.
And that was Alejandro G. Iñárritu's The Revenant.
Yes, The Revenant.
Yes. Revenant. When did you end up seeing it?
I went and saw it Saturday night.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Great.
At the last showing. And it was relatively full. I sat in the regular seats that we sit in, but the theater was still very full for the 9:30 show.
Yeah, that's where I sat. And we went to, it was actually like a Wednesday showing of it. And it was really full theater. It was like a 7 o'clock showing, but it was very full.
Cool.
I was very surprised. Yeah. So this movie actually came out a little bit ago mm-hmm. with some select theaters and is kind of expanding. And it did really well at the initial weekend. It actually beat Star Wars in that Friday box office,
right,
which actually surprised me a lot.
Star Wars had been out for several weeks now. So.
But I guess I was basing this all off of Birdman. You know, the numbers that
There's a big difference between a movie where people thought it was like a superhero movie and then coming out of it and going, oh, this was just boring crap. And this movie, which is, you know, survival, you know, Birdman was more internal, mm-hmm. internalizing struggle. This one was an actual man against nature.
Sure.
And that had a much bigger impact on it. It also had the whole revenge story tied in with mm-hmm. it too. So I think that's, and then of course, Leo DiCaprio.
So had Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom
that
Hardy.
That brings people in
right.
a little bit more.
Sure. Starring Leonardo DiCaprio as Hugh Glass and Tom Hardy as, I don't actually remember what his name, Cooper
Fitzgerald.
Or Fitzgerald, that's mm-hmm. right. General overview of the story. Guys are on this trading expedition. Leonardo DiCaprio's character, Glass, is a scout for them. They're out on expedition to collect all of these pelts up in some wild territory. Then things go awry. They get attacked. Their crew goes down. And then from that point on, Leonardo DiCaprio's character, after he gets mauled by a bear, is a struggle for his life
mm-hmm.
as he's left with a few members of his crew. They essentially leave him to die, and then he goes. That's a very brief overview. We can start getting into
it. Yeah, because the bigger thing that you're missing is, you know, his point of the wanting revenge on this and mm-hmm. struggling out is he has a son with an Indian woman.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone in the Indian village was murdered mm-hmm. years before when his son was young. Now the son's a, I don't know, let's say, 18-year-old, 15-year-old,
something like that.
And he wants to stay with his dad, help nurse him back to health. They leave two guys with him,
mm-hmm.
The two guys, Fitzgerald and this other kid, bug out, but not before killing Glass's son,
right.
which is what sets him off in this revenge thing of, I'm going to go and kill these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, that leads into that bigger story.
Right.
Interesting thing, though, as I was doing some research after watching the movie, so this movie, The Revenant, is based on a 2002 book by Michael Punk, or mm-hmm. Punky, but that is based on a true story. In 1939, the Federal Writers Project published The Oregon Trail, The History of an American West, which they mentioned Hugh Glass. So this may be one of the first appearances of Hugh Glass mentioned in historical documents. Everything else passed down among oral tradition. But in 1939, Time magazine called Hugh Glass the angriest man in the U.S. in U.S. history. Right? Here's the real story as related in 1939. In 1823, Glass joined a team led by Andrew Henry that traveled up the Missouri River and the Grand River in modern day South Dakota. So this does not take place in Canada, like we're led to believe in the beginning. Before Glass could shoot a retreat, this is where he was attacked by a grizzly bear. Quote, before Glass could shoot a retreat, the animal had seized him, had bitten out a large chunk of his flesh, which she dropped to her younglings. Glass screamed for his fellows, but before they could kill the bear, he had been mangled from head to foot. So in the movie, we see Glass shoot the bear and then stab it to death and essentially take the bear down himself.
Right.
In, I guess in the real life, he had shot the bear. It wasn't enough to bring him down. The bear was mauling him. The other members of his party came along, fired like five or six muzzle shots into the bear before it collapsed. Mm-hmm. And one of the counts that I read was that, let's see if it says in here, you know, one of the accounts that I had read said that it had ripped the skin off of his face down to the bone. So you could like see his skull underneath there. Right. So he was pretty messed up. And in the movie, it is, it's pretty brutal when you see him afterwards and what's happening. I mean, he's got, his back is ripped up. That's one of the big places where an infection set in the real story. He had broken his leg. His face was badly scarred. In the movie, he had his throat was slashed,
ripped open.
And he had to later seal it back up with a gunpowder burn.
Yeah, that was rough.
Glass did not die, but his fellow travelers did not expect him to survive for long. They could not carry the injured man with them, and since winter was approaching, they could not risk staying with him until he died. The men in the group offered two of their own, $80, to stay with Glass and give him a decent burial once he died. But Glass would not let go of life, and after 5 days, the two men abandoned Glass, scared that they would perish themselves if they stayed any longer. Quote, slipping away, they took with them all of his belongings, his gun, his knife, his flint, and other essentials of wilderness life. These they gave to Henry and asserted that Glass had died. This was their proof that he had died. This is where the story gets really interesting. Glass was in such a rage it had been being abandoned that he dragged himself to the nearest post, Fort Kiowa, 100 miles away. He was so close to starving until he came upon a group of wolves killing a buffalo calf, which we saw in the movie. He scared the animals off, ate the raw meat and of the killed animal. He joined a trapping party on its way to Yellowstone, but there they were attacked by a group of Native Americans, like we saw in the movie. It's the same group, the Akira,
the Arikara, the Cree.
None but Glass, who was saved by another tribe. Another tribe saved him, and he survived. Then he set off alone to the Bighorn Post, where he believed where he was going to exact his revenge. Took him another 38 days to get there.
Oh, my gosh.
Right?
Yeah.
But by the time he got there, the guys that he kind of, I guess, had heard that they were after him, so they split out. Glass joined up with another group of Native Americans. They were killed. And this is... the chief had been killed by the trappers a year before, and Glass and his fellow trappers had been set up. So this was kind of a revenge plot. Glass found himself alone again after all these people got killed. Apparently, when he got back to Fort Kiowa later that spring, people knew that had heard his story and were kind of expecting him. When he got there, he met up with the guys that had deserted him. And nothing. Nothing happened.
Really?
The entire trip had just exhausted him so much over the 9 months that he was doing this, that he was just like, you know what? There's no point in doing this.
Interesting.
There, and they don't explain why he just decided not to do it. He got his gun back, which is really all he wanted. And then he just went on his way and then was later, I guess, like a couple of years later, died. Of some other cause, but it was interesting that nothing happened at the
very interesting.
Yeah. Which I find that interesting that here you can take a story that is inspired by true events, right? You can take the story that I just kind of retold and you can tweak it enough to where you have to add in, why is this man struggling? Just because he's mad at these guys left him behind? No, let's add in the child. Well, let's add in the backstory of this and his whole family and wanting to be reunited with his dead family. And then give him, throw everything in his face that will prevent him from getting back to the fort and seeking his revenge. And that's what makes the story very interesting.
Well, I find it very interesting that in the actual story that he had really no revenge at the end.
Right.
Because that is... this kind of narrative that floats in there when he stumbles upon a native and he has this conversation with them, like revenge is in God's hands or something of that along that lines. And that's what comes in his mind when he's actually doing the last battle with Fitzgerald and he floats him down the river.
Yeah. And let's, and then,
I wrote it down. Arikara.
Yeah. Let them take care of him.
Yeah. Right.
And that was kind of a, more of a thank you for Glass saving the chief's daughter. That's the reason why the Native Americans were chasing him and everyone else in this movie and killing them is because someone had kidnapped his daughter, was raping her. Glass stumbled upon the camp of these guys at some point in the movie, did the right thing, freed the girl and let everyone else go.
Right.
But yeah, it's this idea of, is revenge really something that you need to do or not need to do? Mm-hmm. And it seems like he had kind of burned itself out of him by the end of the movie. And he's just like, okay, let's just see what happens if, you know, put it in God's hands and let it go.
Yeah, let it go.
Interesting. The title of this movie, Zach, is The Revenant. Do you know what a revenant is?
Oh, well, I do because it was on the poster.
Oh, was it?
It was on the very first poster they released. It was, one who has returned as if from the dead or something like that.
One that returns after death or a long absence.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because if you're looking at this, there are essentially 3 points or 4 points in this movie where Glass dies and is reborn.
Mm-hmm.
The first death is after the bear attacks him and they leave him for dead in the shallow grave. He wakes up and crawls over to his dead son. He's pretty much resigned to just die there with his son, but something urges him forward.
Right.
So that would be like the first death and resurrection when he finally gets out of that first spot. Second time is when he comes across the other Native American who is looking for more of his people after his family has been killed. And Glass is burning up from infection. And the Native American builds a little steam hut with some medicinal herbs and stuff in there and packs him in there for a couple of days and hopes that the heat and the steam and everything heals him. So he passes out. When he emerges from that, that's his second return or rebirth.
Sure.
You know where his third one would be?
I'm going to guess his third one would be from the horse he cut open and took all the guts out of.
Yeah. Isn't that weird? I mean, they've got this in there that he metaphorically dies multiple times in this movie, or is it near death? And each time the director brings him back to continue on to his journey.
Yeah, it's a very nice cinematic thing, especially tying into the whole film, because I think there's also this, and the final one, I feel like, at the end when he floats Fitzgerald down and he's kind of resigned to, I mean, there's the tree element that keeps recurring, this vision he's having of his wife, and this kind of rebirth of letting it go and just carrying on. But I definitely think those three are very, I mean, one, he literally comes out of a grave.
Yeah.
One, he's pretty much in like a form, and they're all kind of forms of graves that he emerges out of after surviving.
But do you know that each time he seems to have a different reason for continuing? You know, the first is, I got to get moving because I'm going to go kill those guys who killed my son.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really deep in his gut, I'm going to kill you. The second time he's reborn and finds later that the Native American that saved him is killed, he comes out as being more, I don't want to say neutral, but it seems like he is more accepting that it's okay to accept the help from others. Then the third time, he and the horse go off a cliff. The horse just lands on the ground. He goes through a tree that breaks his fall, but the horse is just dead.
Oh, very dead.
But when he reemerges from that horse, there's a moment where he respects the horse and is essentially, even though we don't hear anything being said, you can tell he's thanking the horse for the sacrifice that the horse made. So he's going through this next kind of rebirth or re-understanding of himself of, you know, sometimes other things have to die for other things to live. Maybe then he's starting to tie that back with his son. Maybe his son had to die so that he could live, or he had to kill the soldiers, which is one of the things that pops up a couple of times in the story where he kills these French soldiers that had killed his family. He had to kill that soldier so his son could live. So it's very, I mean, there's this kind of obviously a big push between life and death and coming to grips with that multiple times. But I'm surprised that this was didn't take more of a religious bent or a spiritual bent than it did, which is interesting.
I think there's definitely elements in there. I alluded to these flashback or visions he's essentially having of his wife and his child and this in the tree. Also, you know, there's these visual elements they're throwing in, and you're right, it is kind of just lightly in there, this spiritual type of thing. And especially I think when you look at the rebirth coming out of the horse, where he's thinking the horse, and it's like this thinks of nature, of this cosmic balance of life and death he's acknowledging. And it's, I mean, you almost got to look at it like the first rebirth is of himself.
Right.
And then of kind of community, essentially, kind of the people around you. And then the third one is this giant force of nature that he's becoming aware of or giving thanks to.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. What'd you think of the acting?
The acting is very interesting in this film because, like The Martian we talked about, DiCaprio is by himself most of the film. But I felt like his, what he did in the beginning of the film with actors, I thought was great and kind of, sparse to a point because he doesn't really talk much. He's still kind of not really part of the crew. He's just kind of hired on as to guide him. So he's not really one of them. So I think he does that well. But then, like, getting mauled by the bear, like, that scene was just insane. Or just watching him, like, struggle. You can just see the strain in his face when they're trying to stitch him up. Or he's got, like, dirt all up in his mouth. And he's trying to do something when he's killing his son. When Fitzgerald is killing his son. Yeah, I thought, and then just the whole journey of him going through, I just thought was amazing for how little he talked, how much he could emote.
Once he's mauled, I mean, he's struggling to talk because his throat is all ripped up.
Right.
And so it is really interesting to see him work through that. I thought it was really good.
Especially, I mean, the physical elements. I'm sure he had a lot of stunt people, but there's still some stuff he's going to have to do. He's going to have to, well, besides just like freezing the entire time. I thought Tom Hardy's performance was exceptional.
Oh yeah.
In the film.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the probably better roles Hardy's ever done, where I really feel like Hardy is a really great actor where he kind of goes into a role and you don't really see much carryover between performances and Hardy's acting. And this one I really felt is just completely different than what he's done and just is that character completely. It was just, I felt like it was just phenomenal. Yeah. And he got to talk more, which kind of helped.
Right. And it was interesting, just to hear his justifications and his reasonings for doing things.
Yeah, I thought that character was really interesting because on some level, you're talking about survival in this brutal, brutal wilderness. You can understand, like, hey, this guy's, he's dead. Yeah. Let's leave him. There's no reason for all of us to die. If he is just going to, I mean, we're just going to sit here and he's going to die and then we're all going to die. What's the point? Right. You can, especially in that time period where they are, how the conditions are, you can definitely kind of have sympathy for
him.
Yeah.
It makes it very intense and scary that if we don't get somewhere where there's shelter, we will die here, either from the elements or from Native Americans or animals or whatever that can
absolutely
kill us.
Yeah. I thought his performance was great and I was glad to see he got nominated for a supporting actor for Academy.
So they shot this up in Canada.
They did.
And they also ended up shooting it in Argentina.
Yeah, they did.
Because they were chasing snow, which I found very interesting because there was a story in Hollywood Reporter sometime back, right, Zach?
Mm. It was like in July.
Yeah.
Because that's how long this production lasted.
It's been going for a long time. But what was the big story about?
So the big story was that, you know, they are shooting up, you know, in the wilderness in times where, you know, the weather is changing, it's brutal, it's cold. They said sometimes it could be
like
higher.
Degrees.
Sometimes it was negative 20 with negative 40 wind chill. And they would be shooting technically a fall scene. So in your honesty, would ask the actors not to wear hats and gloves because technically in the sequence of the film, they wouldn't be really there yet.
Right.
In that. And so they had these harsh conditions where they're going into wilderness. You know, they're not really taking much. They're not taking generators because they're not
taking
a lot
of anything. Well, here's the thing. I mean, it's fascinating in that the director, what is his name?
Alejandro.
Yeah. They shot this because they needed to follow the seasons.
Right.
They shot it in sequence.
Oh, yeah.
They shot from, and this is not something that normally happens in a movie. You shoot everything that needs to happen here. You need it here and here and here. And so he's like, okay, well, we're going to go up here. All the stuff that happens at the beginning of the movie, we're just shooting this in order, page one, page two, page three, all the way through. And then you hit the brutal snows. And again, you're right. They don't have generators because places where they were at, they were not allowed to bring in heavy generators. They were not allowed to bring in off-road vehicles. They were not allowed to bring in giant cranes. They couldn't put in tracks or anything like that.
Right.
So they were like not, and you couldn't fly in helicopters to do stuff. So you were literally, I forget how they said they were doing it, as some kind of a trestle system that they had to build between trees to get cranes up to the top of the areas that they were shooting. So they were in a very wilderness area, sub-zero temperatures. And I can understand why people are grumping and grousing about, we are in these horrible working conditions,
right?
Uncomfortable working conditions.
Yeah. Some they in the Hollywood Reporter piece in July, which they ran in July, and they said it was unusual for Inarritu to give a interview at this point, because technically they were still in production, because they took a very long break, because as you mentioned, they ran out of snow in Canada, so they had to go all the way to the southern tip of Argentina to find snow so they could actually finish the film. So they take a break for this, and this is when it got out. You started seeing reports like there was like a living hell shooting this film. And so he gave an interview to kind of, you know, let everyone know what was happening. And because they said there was a lot of people that would quit, people got fired. The Hollywood Reporter piece says a lot of it was part of a miscommunication between one of his producers and the director. And so that was causing a lot of issues.
But here's the thing.
Yeah.
Alejandro wanted to do this because if we did this in green screen, if we did this in blue screen and fake snow and all this stuff, and you were at the end of your shot, you were drinking coffee and going back to your trailer or everything, he didn't feel that you would get the performance out of the talent or the crew to really make it feel like I am in a miserable spot. I am crawling through snow, dragging myself through these bitter conditions if they had done it on a soundstage.
Right.
Which, now that you look at the finished piece, you can see the pain in everyone's eyes, in the fact that we are out here and this is horrible. You can see that. And I think, even though, I don't know, some people may question the motive, it really paid off. I think it really worked to do it both shooting in, you know, shooting order in script order, and doing it in those conditions, I think, led to a better performance in the storytelling.
Yeah, especially because, you know, we look at Glass's character arc where, you know, kind of in the story, essentially he's like, he's tired. He doesn't want to do this.
Right.
Well, Leonardo was probably very tired at the end of this shoot, even with those breaks. I mean, they had to do physically grueling things and kind of put their bodies through it. And Alejandro said everyone knew what they were getting into.
Right.
That, like, this is what it was going to be. Right. Like, he wasn't lying. He's like, oh, we're going to be in sound stages in Canada. Just kidding. We're going to be in like 4 feet of snow in Canada. So people knew what it was. And obviously this is not something you would normally find on a Hollywood set, because obviously it's got all this, you know, talk about how incredibly grueling it was for people. And some people, I think, will laud him for doing this. Be like, well, you are, this is the reason you do this is because you got this performance and you look at the film, find its production, and it is fantastic. But obviously there are drawbacks doing it where people are like, this is kind of brutal, man.
I think in the end, though, when we see Leonardo DiCaprio winning a Golden Globe, there's a reason why, right?
Oh,
he's really putting this in. When you see Tom Hardy being nominated, there's a reason why he's being nominated here. The next interesting thing is, because they're out in the middle of nowhere, and this is the thing that I noticed when it was shooting, I was like, there's no freaking way there are lights in this scene. This is a minimum crew. This is live locations.
Yeah.
No way that they're using anything but natural light. And sure enough, all they had were bounce cards, cutters, which are basically ways to block light, negative fill, which is black reflector. Just imagine a reflector black.
Yeah.
And that's all they used to light this.
Yeah.
They had some light bulbs, I guess, some like household light bulbs.
Oh, okay.
That they would put a bunch of them in a couple of scenes, like around the campfire. If the winds were blowing, it was causing too much flicker, so they would supplement it with some like regular household bulbs bundled together to cast off the light from that. But other than that, it was the natural conditions of that environment. And they only had a little bit of time each day to shoot.
Right.
Because during the winter time, it was like 9:30 in the morning until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That's all the time that you could get anything decent.
Right.
And originally they wanted to shoot this on film.
They did.
Which I found was very fascinating.
Yeah, which is something I thought of while I was watching it, because there are some campfire scenes where obviously we're not using any light or very minimal. We're using all natural stuff from a fire. And it was crisp, so good quality.
Yeah,
I thought there was there was a moment I was like, this could have been filmed because of the range they're getting and just the vividness of it. But then you get into this low light. I'm like, oh no, this is beautifully shot digital low light
stuff.
Yeah,
it is. And that was, compare that to Hateful Eight, which is 70 millimeter film. We're doing all these things. And then you get into the cabin and it is all set up stage lighting compared to doing this natural lighting out in the field. And they can't get it with film. They were having too many problems with the film. They did, I think they shot about, they said 13 or 20 minutes of stuff, but there were too many problems.
And none of it made it into the
processed.
Final.
It was, you know, had all sorts of problems. So they ended up not using it at all. And they went with the Arri Alexas digital cameras to shoot everything. They had two cameras and about a dozen lenses ranging from 14 millimeters, which is a wide shot, to I think
26.
24, 26. Yeah, 26 was their closest one, which is still... in 35 millimeter film, 50 millimeters is considered normal, kind of like what our eye sees. And so essentially this movie was shot wide so that you could not only see the bleakness of the environment, but you could see where the character fit in with that environment.
Right.
The other thing that I found interesting was, and this again was something we saw in Birdman, and probably what was the other film that the director of photography, didn't you say something about the...
Lubezki did Gravity as well.
But what was the Tree
of... Tree of Life as well.
Is that the one that we were looking at?
Yeah,
that nobody liked, except
for you? Yes, the film that I liked, and a lot of other
Matthew
people, most people don't.
Yeah, so Tree of Life, and that was the director of photography. He was the director of photography on
right,
that.
Okay, yeah.
So same director of photography.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that they did is they, especially with these lenses, is they got in super, super close.
Yes.
I mean, you see DiCaprio sitting there breathing. You see the breath coming out of his mouth, and it's probably his real breath coming out.
Oh, yeah, probably.
But, I mean, the camera's just pushing in and pushing in and pushing in and pushing in. And there were times, I was reading an article in American Cinematographer where they were like, the lens was literally touching his cheek in order to get the shot that we needed and still be able to see all of the background out there. Just fabulous, especially in the one scene where the avalanche is taking place, where they're right up on his face after the death of the leader of the expedition. And then there's an avalanche that goes off behind him, and you're able to get that all in focus throughout that entire time.
Yeah.
With this big wide lens.
It was great seeing some behind the scene images in that American Cinematographer article, because, you know, you're talking about these really wide images, but there's a lot of tight shots in this.
Oh, yeah.
And you can see. Lubezki has one of his cameras, and it's a tight shot of DiCaprio and his wife, and the camera is just smashed
up
against
him.
Like, oh, that'd be, I mean, that's amazing.
Which, you know, that's the nice thing about this, and I've said this before, like when I've taught class before, is that if you're going to go without a tripod, and here they're doing a lot of crane work, or they're doing a lot of steady cam work in this piece, if you want a steady shot, make it as wide as you possibly can make it and get close to your subject, and that will make your shot a lot less shaky than standing 5 feet away or 3 feet away from somebody and zooming in, because that's just going to amplify all of your movements. So I think that was kind of a smart move.
Yeah.
And so,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
And then so the other thing is, because the camera is always moving in this, it allowed them to do some incredibly long shots. Not to the extent of Birdman, where it's supposedly all one continuous take, which
obviously
it isn't. But there were scenes in this movie that I had to stop as it was going, is this still the same shot? And sure enough, it is the same shot, like the attack on the camp at the very beginning of the movie.
Right.
All one shot. That entire sequence is one shot.
Did you see some of the digital edits in there?
No, I wasn't. I was just like, wow, this is really good. And I'm like, I think they're doing this all in one shot, and I don't know where any edits or anything are going on.
There's a couple, and they talk about in that piece where they go from steady cam to crane and stuff. So you know there's edits in there. And I think if you go back and watch that opening sequence again and know they're going for a one shot, you can kind of see like two digital edits and kind of, or when he's like going into the water
and out of it and stuff. Out,
And I only knew that because I know Birdman and how that movie fascinated me.
Right,
so I was looking for this. But yeah, I think the bear attack scene is pretty much just one shot. The fight at the end between Glass and Fitzgerald is one shot.
Right.
Through the whole thing, there are so many
and when
just long shots.
The leader of the expedition goes back to the camp, look, I mean, a lot of these are really, really long takes. Like when he's running through the camp and he's like, where's Fitzgerald? He's got the gun in there. That's all one big long take as he's winding through that camp, the fort.
Right.
And that's, I mean, they had to build that fort.
Oh, yeah.
And they built the fort. The cool thing was, because they knew what their environment was going to be, they built the fort so that every window faced south to where they could get maximum light exposure.
Nice.
And if you look like where scenes where they're interviewing people, they're either right by a window or right by a big open door.
Mm-hmm.
And in some scenes where you actually had to pass through, like that one, they would actually have cut out sections of the set that would allow more light into area. So
yeah,
it was just incredible to see these long shots being used and being used effectively.
Right.
But, and here's the other thing that's amazing and why I think that the director of photography is going to get something. Although, you know, some people could argue, director of photography, he didn't really use anything because he didn't have any lights. He just used natural light. So blah, blah, blah. But
I guess
that, in my opinion, is awesome that he was able to use natural light, but it caused all sorts of problems because not only is he pulling focus live, and we're talking focus from like 3 inches to 50 feet, that you're constantly having to do that. He's also having to constantly adjust exposure and iris because they're going into these very dark areas and these very light areas, and he's got to balance that out quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we were talking to Oscars last week or a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm changing my mind. I think that this movie could.
You think it's going
to
get it?
As much as Hollywood loves to pat itself on the back, Tom Hardy's character was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Leonardo DiCaprio's acting was awesome. The cinematography in this movie is awesome. And the directing is really, really good.
I think so, too.
So, and then the movie overall is just very engaging.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's 5 awards right there that I think that it could easily win.
Speaking of the Oscars, Emmanuel Lubezki, the director of photography, won the last 2 years for Gravity and then Birdman.
Right.
If he wins this year, he will be the only person ever to win 3 in a row. Currently, there are 4 people who have won 2 consecutive. Mm-hmm. That's the most. But mm-hmm. If he wins, he'll be the first 3.
And when we look at what are the other movies up for best cinematography?
Cinematography, I believe, is Mad Max.
Okay, so again, nothing against Mad Max, good movie, but if you think about all the lighting, the extra setups and things that they can do in that compared to someone who's just, I'm working with the sun and some candles, people, look what I'm able to deliver.
I know.
Here's the winner. What's another one that we have up there?
I'm trying to pull it up really quick. I think, I'm trying to just remember what I watched this year. Of course, I didn't put those down in my
production
sheet.
I've got them here.
Okay.
Cinematography, Carol, which
I haven't seen. We talked about that.
Yeah, we talked about Hateful Eight, which again,
right,
really good, but I mean, it's set up lighting and it looks like you're watching a stage play.
Mm-hmm.
Mad Max, The Revenant, and Sicario.
Oh, Sicario, yeah.
Sicario, which I haven't watched. It's available right now on iTunes. I was almost going to watch it, but then the youngest was like, well, that doesn't look like a very good movie. And it's like, yeah, it's probably not for you. So, but if you compare all of that, working just with your natural light and nothing else and just minimal supplemental light, my God, that's amazing for this movie.
Yeah. And I think obviously when people paint with light, there's a lot of beautiful things they can
do.
Right. But if we're talking about cinematography complementing a film, I think the natural aesthetic of this film is the perfect complement to the story.
But see, here's the thing. You can just pull out your camera and start shooting in your house and go, oh, look, natural light.
Yeah,
but
sure.
No, think about it. If I were to go upstairs and shoot in the morning, the natural light in one room is not going to be that fantastic. But I wait a few hours until 10 or 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock when the sun's coming in and it's illuminating and bouncing off walls and creating some nice light and reflections throughout the room, then that's a pretty room.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I wait until towards the evening when the sun's setting, I got long shadows in the room and I've got some golden areas of the room and more light bouncing off, that's something else all completely as well. And that can be used to great effect, but I could also just go in and throw up a bunch of lights and do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to just bounce that light around and do that and just work, I have a great respect for people who can just use natural light and not make it look like crap.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not think that any point in this, there's 2 points in this movie where I was a little disappointed in the lighting, but they were both inside at night with a fireplace, and that's it. Otherwise, it's like, this is some beautiful lighting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm betting all he's doing is using the natural light of the sun, and boom, there you go.
Yeah, and so then that should give you an idea. You talk about these shadows, and light is when it's good and when it's not as great. I mean, that should give, you guys listening, an idea of why this production got stretched so far, because they're not being able to pull in these huge K-lights so they can get all this nice lighting that they need any time of the day that they want it. They have to wait for that perfect moment to actually shoot the scene. You know, in the elements, getting to some real, you know, film nerdery, they talked about in the American Cinematographer piece about how it was so cold that it was throwing off the back focus of these lens. So they had to work with Panavision and Alexia to fine-tune these lenses so they could give them a degree of like error when it got so cold.
Yeah, so it's like, if it gets cold, you need to use this lens.
Right.
If it's between this temperature and this temperature, use this lens. If it's between this temperature and this temperature, use this set of lenses. And if it's this temperature or below, use this set of lenses.
Right, which is just absurd that you have to, you know, you're going in to fine-tune so in to make it perfect. And you have all the technical little tweaks that these people do to their cameras to just make their films perfect.
Just to get the best thing. And I think that's really important in a discussion for anybody who's listening and wants to work on something is it's not just turn the camera on and go. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, a lot of people, when they have their handy cams or whatever that they buy, they just turn it on and they go. They don't think about focus. They don't worry about framing shots or anything like that. It's just like, turn it on and let's shoot. And then later they're like, well, that doesn't look very good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you go into your camera settings, and even a $200 camera that I can get at Walmart, I can go in and I can adjust the iris, the exposure, the white balance. I can go and adjust frame rates and all that stuff and get something that looks really good on a cheap camera. But it takes time to understanding of your equipment to do that.
You know, I would throw this into the Western genre of the time.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Where do you think it kind of lands at story-wise? Let's go from there. Story-wise, where do you think it kind of lands in the Western genre? Do you think it kind of followed a standard type of Western story? Or do you think it's kind of playing with it like we've seen these Western genres do really in the last year?
It's hard to say where it kind of lands because too often when we think of Western, I mean, maybe it's maybe close to Unforgiven territory, but not quite. I mean, it's really Man Against the Elements kind of stuff. So it would probably fall on the, as far as action goes, and there's surprisingly amount of action in here.
Yeah.
I would say it's on the low to mid range of action as far as Westerns go with shoot 'em up, bang, bang type stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas something like, shoot out the OK Corral or Wyatt Earp or one of those movies might be on the high end of this range because it's man against man and guns are blazing and all of that stuff and fast actions and that. That's not this. This is a quieter film, but it's still very, very engaging.
Mm-hmm. And do you think Lubetzky did some typical Western type of shots? We have some vistas and
Why they wanted to use the wide. That's why they wanted to use the wide angle because they wanted to show the environment and kind of capture this wide Western feel. And so that's why when I mentioned the avalanche scene, that's one where you're capturing the beauty of the nature around you, or just when they're walking through the woods or along the riverbanks, or just these kind of reestablishing shots of where we're at in the wilderness works really, really well.
Avalanche scene. Now you just, it reminds me of that French film that came out like a year and a half ago, Force Majeure with the avalanche. That reminds me of that now.
Interesting thing about that first when I read it, I was like, or first when I saw the movie and saw the avalanche coming, I was like, okay, not another chase moment right now. And then you saw, well, it's no way is it going to come to them. And then part of me was thinking, I wonder if that was a natural avalanche that happened and everybody just stayed in character and composure, and it was just one of these happy accident things. First of all, not digital. It was a real avalanche, but they worked with the park services or the mountain rangers or whoever they are.
Set one off.
For a controlled detonation at the exact precise time that it needed to happen. So here you have the director of photography and the director communicating with one another back and forth so that when Leonardo DiCaprio has this one moment in his eye, that they can trigger that avalanche at that precise moment so that it starts happening at then. So there was so much coordination going on just for that one shot.
That's fascinating.
I found another thing that I found very interesting.
What's
about
that?
This. This comes from Yahoo Tech.
Okay.
So they wanted to try some science on this thing. So this group called Lightwave, It's a Fox Studios partnered with a small bioanalytics software company called Lightwave to measure the audience reacting to the film. So they basically put on one of these Fitbits that you use kind of at the hospital grade to measure everything about your pulse, your heart rate, all of this stuff that's going on. And here's what they found. There were 15 moments of fight or flight in the movie where the audience really literally had a reaction of, I need to, you know, a scared reaction to it. 14 heart pounding moments. And then the most amazing thing, 4,716 seconds or 76 minutes of the movie where people were absolutely still in the theater. Not wiggling around in their seat, not yawning, just 76 minutes of just being transfixed into the story on the scene.
And that is amazing to me. But then when I think back on our theater experience, I remember just the theater just being just dead.
Yeah, quiet
just
the entire time. Yeah.
And then even, I don't know about you, but when those credits started rolling, the last scene when Leonardo DiCaprio looks like straight into the lens and it runs, no one was like moving.
No one
was talking. It was like silence.
And I was
just
really surprised
trying to get back from it.
As the credits started rolling, people still were sitting in their seats, which
never happens.
Usually never happens unless they know there's a post-credit sequence, which this one does not have.
No.
And the audience knew it, but they still stayed in there and probably until midway through the credits when I was like, okay, I'm going to get up and go now. But most of the audience was still there halfway through the credits.
Yeah. Which is just, I think, a testament to what they pulled off for the film.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, it's just a, you just have this visceral reaction through it, or you, I mean, like as the biometric show, which is just phenomenal that they would kind of do that.
I know, right?
Just this show. I mean, I've seen people when they do the eye scans to look at images and stuff.
But now you just strap it on your wrist. Yeah,
that's really cool.
A great idea to do that.
Yeah.
So, what else do you want to talk about on this?
What else did I want to talk about? I think I had something else. I mean, where do you think it in lands? A lot of my friends and I've been having a discussion of this against Hateful Eight. I think it's a weird no comparison.
They're both Westerns.
Yeah.
They're both big epic storytelling, but one is essentially a comedy and the other one is a hard drama. There's not really a comparison you can make except that they both take place in the winter and they both take place in the West.
Maybe that's why everyone's like, we were just trying to draw, or I still haven't seen Hateful Eight because it didn't come to our theater.
Right.
But I know some of my friends have. And so we were just talking back and forth about both films.
Yeah,
and
Hateful Eight is like movie violence.
Mm-hmm.
Revenant is like real violence.
Did you ever have like a reaction to when he's eating meat or stuff? I watched this one with Aubrey and some parts she was like, ugh, I did not,
not in The Revenant, but if you watch The Hateful Eight, there are moments where somebody gets their, a couple of times where people get their heads blown off and they shatter like watermelons.
Sure.
And that is where you can hear in the theater, people are like, oh, you know, like gross, getting sick. But in this one, you see the scenes where he's eating the raw meat or the raw liver and throwing it back up and nobody in the audience had a reaction to that, which I found interesting.
You know, this movie, for as well as I've responded to it, and everyone I've talked to respond to it, it has a lower Rotten Tomato rating. It has, you know, it's got like, I think, mid to low 80s. I think it's in the, mid 80s.
I can see it's not
super
action-packed.
What do you think is pulling that down?
No love interest.
Okay.
Except for the love of your dead wife.
Sure.
That's not nonstop action. When you look at Mad Max, that's a nonstop action movie, which you could also throw into the Western category. It's not, it's not horses, it's motorcycles and cars, but it's the same kind of an idea of a lawless territory. So, you know, Mad Max has got nothing but action nonstop. This one's got Leonardo DiCaprio. And I think there's a group of people who are tired of Leo and his Leo-ness and the fact that he can do no wrong. So I think that probably impacts it a little bit.
Sure.
So people are probably a little bit more critical.
Mm-hmm.
The ending of the film may turn off some people because it's like, well, I don't get why did he just let the guy go and let the Indians kill him as opposed to just taking care of it himself. And what does that last shot mean? So it could be a unsatisfying ending of, well, did he live or not live? Well, you know, what's going on kind of thing. So I can see those would be some reasons why some people bring it down. Do you have some ideas or reasons?
You know, I've read some people who were critical of the runtime, which is about 156 minutes.
You had said you didn't feel like it was that long, and you know what?
I really did
not feel like it was that long either.
No, I really didn't. And he says, you know, really long movies, I will be hesitant to go back to the theater and watch them again because it's just an investment. Mm-hmm. You're like, well, I've seen it. I'll wait until it comes out again. This is one of those films where it just goes by so fast, or you're just so into the film that the time just kind of slips mm-hmm. by. You don't even recognize mm-hmm. it. And that's how I felt with this one is. So, I mean, I guess if you're somehow something popped you out of being in the film, you could probably be aware of how long the film was because it is. Mm-hmm. It's in 2.5 hours. It's not like it's a little quick jaunt, 90 minutes. It's
all, right.
It's almost it,
is a, it is a long movie, and that can turn a lot of people off.
Yeah, that can turn people off. And you're right, I think it is. I don't think I would say it's slow, but I want to say it's a quiet film, like you mm-hmm. said earlier, where it moves along, but it is very sparse. There's not a lot of dialogue. Sometimes there's very little music. It just kind of plays out with some grunting and river tricklings.
Yeah.
Which I'm just...
There's not a lot of dialogue.
No, yeah, like I just freaking loved. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was really looking forward to this film, but I think all of my expectations were blown away. And I think this is the best film of the year.
I think it is. I mean, if you look and see what it's already won, it has, what do we got here? Oops, let me back up here. There's a really cool, if people are into film, maybe you already know this, but I would really recommend getting the American Cinematographer app on mm-hmm. your iPad to read the issues there because maybe your local bookstore doesn't carry the magazine or anything like that. But it's got some really cool advanced features in it that make the story more interesting because of what they can include. So 12 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, winner of 3 Golden Globes, 2 winners in the Critics' Choice Award, Screen Actors Guild Award nominee for Outstanding Performance by a Male Actor in a Leading Role, 7 BAFTA nominations for Best Film, Actor, Director, Cinematography, Editing, Makeup and Hair and Sound.
So, oh, yeah, the makeup in this film.
Yeah.
Which I hadn't seen it when the Golden Globes came out and they were nominated for makeup and then they got nominated, I think, for an Oscar for the makeup. Just astounding. Mm-hmm. Like how mm-hmm. much his body gets beaten up and mm-hmm. oh yeah. Mm-hmm. That one was I didn't expect, but it was just phenomenal. So overall, very happy with the Revenant, Steven.
I was really happy with it. I was expecting it to not be as interesting
mm-hmm.
as it was, and I was transfixed the entire time. Very
fantastic. Very yeah, I felt the same way. I was just enthralled with it. I think Inarritu is going to be like the director for the next couple of years. I think everyone will now
probably
after Birdman and this will be just dying to see what his next project are. I think Emmanuel Lubezki or Chivo, as they'll call him, or Inarritu will reference him as,
mm-hmm.
is probably the best cinematographer working right now. For my taste, at least, I think I love his work. Tree of Life, I thought,
mm-hmm.
Is just gorgeous.
Oh, from the cinematography standpoint, I agree with you completely there. From the story standpoint, I was not a big fan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, of the Tree of Life.
Oh, the Tree of Life. Yeah,
from a cinematography standpoint, fantastic.
Oh, yeah. I know you hate that. I know you don't like Tree of Life. But yeah, what he did there, the opening scene of Gravity, I think, laid the stage for what he did in Birdman.
Mm.
Birdman was just next level. But this, I think there's an element of gimmickiness to Birdman, I think it did it well, but the idea of the one shot.
Right.
But with this, integrating long takes into just beautiful shots and not mm-hmm. being almost restricted by the one shot,
mm-hmm.
Just played to his strengths just amazingly well.
Yep. Before we get out of here this week,
yes,
I want to give a quick review of The Big Short.
Oh,
without getting too spoilery.
Okay.
This is a movie I don't recommend seeing in the theater.
Okay.
There was probably only about 8 people in the theater when I saw it. But it is a fascinating movie to watch in the way that they tell a very boring story.
Okay.
And the information in this is super boring. Mm-hmm. This is not the comedy that the trailer makes it appear to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's real life events, but it at times feels like you're watching a documentary, a real documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are times where you feel like you're watching a reenactment to a documentary. And then, you know, right in the middle of where it feels like you're watching a documentary, the actor breaks the fourth wall and addresses the audience.
Oh,
which is really weird. There's interesting flashbacks, jump forwards, back and forth that happen in this movie that I think are fascinating from the storytelling standpoint. And then because the housing market and loans and all this stuff is confusing to begin with,
mm-hmm.
when they get to a difficult concept to grasp,
mm-hmm.
they basically just stop the movie and say, hey, we need to explain this to you. So at one point when they're trying to explain CODs, mm-hmm. I still couldn't tell you what a COD is. At one point, the main narrator actor guy, Ryan Reynolds,
mm-hmm.
Basically stops and says, I know COD sounds really confusing, right? So here's Margot Robbie in a bubble bath to explain it to you. And you cut to Margot Robbie with her full on Australian accent in a bubble bath, explaining what a COD is in a, you know, just basically explaining it to you. And then afterwards she's like, okay, get the F out of here. And then you're back right into the story. And then there's another part where they're trying to explain, I think it was like a hyper loan or something, hyper security or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, okay, again, this is a really hard concept to grasp. And they just stop and they just, this is a hard concept to grasp. So here is this economic psychologist or something and Selena Gomez gambling to explain it to you. And then they're at a blackjack table and they're explaining how this bet and side bets and all these things start piling up, which is kind of what was going on in the housing market. So it made it a little bit easier to understand what was going on.
Uh-huh.
It's an interesting movie. It's a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, I mean, like, everybody's in this movie. Like, I didn't know Brad Pitt was in this movie.
Yeah.
And he plays this little bit role, but he's really intense in this bit role that he plays. And just, you know, people are popping out of the woodwork left and right in this. And mm-hmm. it's very good. Even Christian Bale is really good in his portrayal of this one guy. But I think you should watch it just from the way that they present a story and an idea.
Yeah.
Because it is just really weird where it's, at first I was like, oh, is this kind of going to be kind of like The Office in the way that they're doing this pseudo documentary kind of thing? And then they're breaking the fourth wall and they're doing all this other stuff. And
that's so strange.
I mean, this is a boring movie.
Yeah.
Because of the subject matter.
Yeah, subject.
But it's amazing in how they're telling it.
That's so, I've been interested in this movie since I knew it was Adam McKay, mm-hmm. who does all the Will Ferrell, essentially, yeah, yeah. you know, Step Brothers and stuff like yeah. that. But that, you describing it, is so off the wall that I'm so much more intrigued about this film that I can't wait for it to actually come out so I can watch it now.
Yeah. I mean, I got it in the last day of the theater.
Mm-hmm.
That night, the last time we recorded, I was like, you know what, I'm going to go watch this movie right now, and I did.
Yeah.
But I do have it already ordered on iTunes.
Yeah.
But it's not one I think is worthy of a theater experience.
Okay.
Definitely worth a home viewing experience.
All right.
So well, it'll be interesting if this does anything. I'm so amazed that it's been nominated.
Really?
For the Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
But I can see why just from that weird, quirky storytelling method that it's using.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's very interesting.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yep.
So we'll wrap up this week's episode. But there, look at that. Two movies. Double the movie talk for the price of one. Free podcast. So that's it for this week's episode of Zach on Film. Head over to Majorspoilers.com where you can find all sorts of comic book news, movie news, television news, everything to get you through the week when you're not listening to a great Major Spoilers podcast. While you're there, click on that Amazon.com link where you can probably buy Birdman on Blu-ray or Gravity or The Tree of Life.
You definitely can do that.
All those great films you want to watch. It's not going to cost you any extra when you use that link, but a little bit will come back to Major Spoilers to help keep all the great content coming to you week after week after week. Next week, we'll be back with more film talk on Zach on Film.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.